especially when the undertaking is trying to determine the reality of experiences like the one I present here. During my 45-plus years investigating contactee cases, there are very few that I still find intriguing or unexplained. Most of the contact experiences I have documented have a psychological explanation or possibly involving some form of paranormal entities. But there are three or four physical contact cases in my files that to this day I find of special interest, as they differ in quality from the rather hazy visionary experiences related by most contactees. One of these physical contact cases involves a Swedish woman, Anna, pseudonym, today 95 years and living in Stockholm. I have promised not to reveal the real name until after her death, but presented a short summary of her narrative in my book Framlingar på vår jord. UFO kontakter i Sverige, Aliens on Earth. UFO contacts in Sweden. A Finnish edition was published in 2011. Anna was born 1920 in Stockholm but spent most of her life in other countries, USA, England and France. She lived 11 years in Mexico with her second husband George, pseudonym, who worked as a chief engineer at the American company Combustion Engineering in Mexico. Anna lived an upper-class life with diplomats, movie stars and royalties. During her stay in Mexico, she met and became a good friend with actress Dolores del Rio at a party with the Mexican president. Dolores del Rio and her husband were interested in UFOs, and Anna was invited to the Dolores residence in Mexico City, where she met about 20 people who all had personal UFO encounters. In the autumn of 1959, Anna and George were living in Mexico City. One day George came home and told he had met a very intelligent and fascinating man named Ben Austin at a conference in Guatemala. In connection with a business trip, Anna and George are invited to Ben Austin's house about 2 hours' travel by car from Guatemala City. The wife of a French diplomat is to take care of Anna's children, from a former marriage, while they are in Guatemala. At the hotel in Guatemala City, Anna and George are picked up by two servants and they travel in a jeep for about 2 hours before arriving at Ben Austin's bungalow. After dinner and some general chatting, Ben dismisses the servants for the day, and now the conversation takes a very different direction. Here, some notes from my interview with Anna. Anna, it was after dinner that he, Ben, suddenly says, "You are interested in UFO. Hakan, he is talking to you?" Anna, "Yes," and I say, "No, I'm not." "Oh, yes you are," he says again. "Hakan, did he speak English?" Anna, "Yes, of course, but he spoke a very peculiar English. Some form of Scottish English. And he said, 'You have even seen a UFO. It was in your native country, and we flew in from the east to your country house in the Stockholm archipelago.'" "Hakan, how did you react then?" Anna, "I became rigid with fear. I was scared. I was really scared. I found the situation very uncomfortable, especially as I hadn't mentioned the UFO incident to my second husband, who had no idea of this incident. He asked if it really was the truth. And I admitted, 'Yes, it is really true.' We had 12 guests at the time. The UFO observation mentioned by Anna occurred in August 1948 or 1949 at Vindo in the Stockholm archipelago. In the evening, Anna goes to fetch something in their underground storehouse. She notices a white light approaching closer over the bay. She runs in to tell the other guests, and they all watch the light stopping in midair and suddenly fly straight up and disappearing in the sky. Anna, all of this I hadn't mentioned for my second husband, and there we are with this man in Guatemala claiming I have seen a flying saucer. Suddenly he says, 'Would you like to take a trip to Venus?' Hakan, he says, 'Venus?' Anna, 'Yes.' And I said, 'No, as I have my children in another country where no one speaks their language and I don't want anything to happen to them.' Then he turned to my husband and says, 'Imagine your wife is so timid. Would you like to go instead?' 'Of course,' he says. I say, 'No, we will both stay.' But my husband absolutely wanted to go. Hakan, was he interested in UFO? Anna, I have no idea, but he was technically interested like most men. He was very eager to go on this trip and we agreed that I should go back to the hotel and was promised that my husband would be back at the Hotel Guatemala City by 6 o'clock in the morning. Later I regretted that I didn't say I wanted to see the craft. Back at the hotel I felt very anxious and couldn't sleep. Exactly at 6 o'clock my husband returned and his face is deathly pale. He had absolutely no color in his face and the eyes were staring. He said it was fantastic, it was absolutely incredible. The start engine for the craft was no bigger than a small piece of sugar and in the shape of a pyramid. After take off there was hardly any sound at all. Hakan, did he describe the craft? Anna, yes. It was round, small with windows all around. I said to him, did you really go to Venus? Then he looked at me and said, you don't believe me. And I had a hard time believing he really did go there, so I said maybe you didn't. Then he became extremely angry and said, if you don't believe me I will not say a word more about this, and then he just went to bed. Later I tried to make him talk men, he never did. What was very strange was that his behavior changed completely. He became threatening and it was very frightening. Hakan, did his behavior change immediately after the experience? Anna, yes it did, and it lasted during the rest of our marriage. He became brutal and I was severely ill, treated and beaten. For a while I thought he was obsessed. I couldn't understand what was happening and I began to wonder if perhaps he hadn't been aboard a saucer but been hypnotized, and that was the reason for his strange behavior. I still don't know if he was outside the garage with that guy down there. I can only tell you what happened, but I can absolutely not guarantee that my husband was in outer space. He became harsh and grim and we were afraid of him. I felt the same fear for this other man, Ben Austin. Hakan, did Ben Austin work at the same company as your husband? Anna, no, not at all, and what would such a person be doing out there in the bush? He said he was keeping an eye on what humanity was doing. I believe he had this place as some sort of station or base. He was small, shorter than me. Maybe 150 centimeter, stocky and heavily built, not nice looking. He wasn't fat but muscular. He was courteous and companionable. His hair was dark, more brown than black, and no beard. Hakan, what nationality did he look like? Anna, well, I asked about his nationality and he didn't answer but claimed he had a Scottish passport. I asked how he got it. Well, he said, if we can build flying saucers we can also arrange such small details. As for Scotland, he said, I have some difficulties with languages and there are so many Scottish dialects. We are checking what humanity is doing so you don't set this planet on fire or other stupidities, as this would make problems for us. When he spoke, I don't know why I felt this terrible fear. My whole being indicated that something is wrong here. Hakan, you mentioned that he wasn't beautiful. Did he have any physical defects? Anna, no. He was dressed in a white shirt. You know, in the tropics when you are invited for dinner they use a tie. His neck was not long and his hair short, but I noticed he had beautifully formed ears. Well, groomed, but his skin color was not nice. Not as dark as the Indians of Guatemala, but rather as a suntanned white person. But the tan didn't look healthy under that brown color. Hakan, how did he live his social life? Anna, he had no family and was entirely alone out there. There were servants but he sent them away, so we were alone all evening. The servants were ordinary natives. There were books. The place was neither beautiful nor ugly, an ordinary bungalow. Hakan, was there a village nearby? Anna, no, there was nothing. The servants came and picked us up in his jeep. There were coffee plantations nearby and large areas of corn cultivation. My husband told me that the craft stood behind the bungalow, surrounded by some bushes and trees, so it was almost impossible to notice. It looked like an ordinary flying saucer but appeared smaller than what you would imagine. I remember he told me they entered from below. It stood on high landing gear, taller than my husband. He didn't have to bend when entering. The landing gear functioned like telescopic legs so they could land anywhere. Ben Austin mentioned that when they flew over my country house in Sweden there were many aboard the craft. Akon, why were you afraid of Ben Austin?
Anna, I have pondered why this was the only two times in my life I have been afraid. I wasn't even scared during an earthquake in Mexico. When we were at my country house in Sweden, it was a nice dinner and the UFO incident was simply a fascinating intermezzo, but as far as I know, I was the only one that felt fear at the time. As for Ben Austin, I can only say he claimed to belong to the space people. I can't guarantee the truth of what he said, only relate what happened to me. After my interview with Anna in her home in Stockholm in 1982, we have kept high regular contact by phone and letter, and she has revealed some more data. Because of his bad temper, her husband was forced to leave combustion engineering in 1975 after having worked in the company for 20 years. He lived in Mexico until his death. Before the UFO incident in 1959, he was never aggressive. After the divorce, Anna only met him once, at the funeral of their son, who died in Mexico in 1998. Her former husband was then sorry that the marriage had ended and implied that it was because of the UFO incident. It had affected him psychologically. It ruined my life, he claimed, and he wanted to forget the whole episode. Anna noticed a peculiar change in his eyes after the UFO incident. From being blue, they had changed to black, gray. When they met at the funeral of their son in 1998, her husband's eyes were blue again. In a phone conversation with Anna July 30, 2009, she said her husband called the craft a sport UFO. Only two people could travel in this craft. He had also said that such craft will be manufactured on Earth. Anna speculates that perhaps it was actually she that should have been taken for a ride in the UFO. She is glad she didn't. Anna remarked that Ben Austin was unattractive as a man, stocky, broad face, the laborer type. As for nationality, he could have been from Sweden. But he was an intelligent man, supposedly working in the atomic industry. Anna is still today convinced that Ben Austin, wherever he came from, was a dangerous man. That his intentions were no good. He is the only man that has made her afraid, except her former husband when he became aggressive. But could this episode be interpreted in a different light? Perhaps her husband simply couldn't cope psychologically with the UFO incident. And the experience was so traumatic that it changed his personality and an inherent destructive tendency opened up. I have found no reason to doubt Anna's claims and experiences. She appears trustworthy, intelligent and honest, but her wish is that this incident in her life should not be told with her name during her lifetime. The Blue John Case and Covert Activities. In his groundbreaking 1983 book George Adamski, The Untold Story, co-written with Lou Zinsdag, Timothy could refer briefly to an old friend he had known for a long time who had met the same or a similar group of benevolent visitors as George Adamski. Although he had not at the time permission to reveal the name of the witness, nor the details of the experiences, he stated that it was, for me, the most reliable contact case I have yet encountered. In a letter to Timothy Good in 1984, I asked why he regarded her as reliable, my contactee friend. Why reliable? I have known her since 1952 and can vouch for her integrity. She has never tried to capitalize on the story, and, indeed, is unable to discuss all the details, due partly to the ET's ability to control her memory of certain things they told her, and also because she was in the Maquis, French resistance, in the last war, and thus is able to keep some information to herself. I hope one day to be able to publish the story. The witness in this contact story died in 1995, and subsequently Timothy Good could publish all the details in his 1998 book Alien Base, although he didn't reveal the full name of the witness, only calling her Joel. Because she was reluctant even to have the story published after her death. p. 248. But already in 1989 I was informed of her full name, Mrs. Joel Marchamont, by ufologist Norman Oliver, who had also been involved in the case. Letter, September 1, 1989. Timothy told me later that I introduced several ufologists to Pixie, as I called her, including Norman Oliver. Email, March 23, 2008. The 9 pages covering the so called Blue John Case have been published on the internet, so here is just a short summary of the story. Joel was born in St. Petersburg, Russia in 1914. After the war she worked in Paris and later moved together with her husband and two daughters, Frederick and Isabel, to London. In September 1963 Joel was in the Sheffield area conducting a house field survey for a market research company. In one of the houses Joel visited she noticed an unusually large amount of modern-looking gadgets, including a large radio transceiver. The lady in the house, Rosamond, explained that her husband was a scientist and radio amateur. When Rosamond briefly left the room Joel heard a message in English from the radio, "We'll be at Blue John tomorrow 4:30 p.m. mark." She wrote down the message but when Rosamond came back she was only informed that message had come through. This obviously shocked Rosamond. Because of her background in the French resistance during the war Joel suspected she had uncovered an international spy ring and decided to go to the Blue John caves at the time mentioned. On Monday September 16, 1963 she went by car to this area and parked at a vantage spot overlooking the valley, and waited. At 4:30 p.m. Joel noticed a brilliant light in the sky which came to rest several hundred yards from her position. The glow ceased and a disc-shaped aircraft appeared instead, landing on tripod landing legs. A man in a one-piece suit stepped out of the craft and simultaneously a man appeared coming from a car parked nearby. Joel recognized the car as the one that had been parked outside Rosamond's house. The two men greeted each other warmly and walked towards the car which drove away. The craft began to glow, lift off from the ground shooting off at a fantastic speed. At that time Joel did not accept the existence of flying saucers and believed the craft to be some sort of secret Russian aircraft. She decided to go back to Rosamond's house to find out more and then perhaps report the incident to the police. When she knocked at the door the scientist husband, in the story named Jack, opened the door but was reluctant to let Joel in. At that point Mark, now in terrestrial clothes, interjected. "That's all right, let her in." Joel tried to present a cover story that she needed some more answers for her field survey. Mark understood that this was a lie and said, "Why don't you tell us the real reason why you are here? You came here because you saw my craft and wanted to find out what was going on." Joel was let in on the truth and spent a large of the night talking with the visitor. She gradually accepted that Mark was indeed a man from another planet. For the next 15 months Joel had several meetings with Mark and another visitor, Val. Two times they met in Joel's flat in London. These men claimed they were secretly working together with a team of scientists from several nations. At one occasion Joel was invited to inspect one of their craft that had landed close to the Welsh border. She helped the visitors in a number of ways. Val and Mark were extremely refined, fair-skinned with perfect teeth. Very kind and perfect gentleman with lots of humor. In 1967, 3 years after the last meeting with Mark and Val, Joel claimed to have been visited by two men from the Home Office in London. They wanted to know about the disappearance of Jack and Rosamond and some other scientists. The men were aware of the contact story but Joel refused to answer some of their questions. Neither did she tell all she knew to Timothy Good. One of the things mentioned by Mark and Val was that their group would intervene in the event of a nuclear catastrophe, if it threatened to destroy our planet. She was also informed that we are spiritual beings, surviving death. The experiences with Mark and Val remained a treasured and vivid memory for Joel all her life. To my knowledge, not much has been written about this extraordinary story, nor has any ufologist tried to follow up on the case, with the exception of Norman Oliver. In the British UFO magazine Gemini, Volume 1, Number 3, July-September 1972, pp. 9-13 Oliver did write a summary of the case with a few added details. "The lack of follow-up was explained to me in a letter from Norman Oliver. To the best of my knowledge she only repeated her claim of the Blue John events to three or four people and specifically requested that it not be checked out further." Undated letter, September 1991. In an earlier letter, Norman Oliver did mention some interesting facts not presented in his article. No follow-up was possible as those concerned was said by Joan Joel, HB, to have left the country soon afterwards, as indeed she did herself. An interesting point, incidentally, was that she herself held no nationality. The area of the occurrence was visited on several occasions and there would seem to be no obvious reason, so far as the terrain is concerned, why events might not have occurred as she stated. Letter, September 1, 1989. Norman Oliver's diagram of the Blue John area. The problem with this case is that there is only one witness, Mrs. Joel Marchamont, and very little circumstantial evidence to support the story. But in his article, Norman Oliver mentioned one intriguing detail. Joan had subsequent meetings with all three visitors, HB, but didn't give further details beyond saying that this spaceman was allegedly for sending another to see Waver Newgovern, then editor of Flying Saucer Review, shortly before his death. It was not until 1970 that I was told, quite out of the blue by a speaker who had come down to a Kensington meeting, of a luncheon engagement kept with Waver Newgovern some weeks only before his untimely death. He had then told his two guests that he had been visited by a man who alleged he was an extra-terrestrial, and who had related the Blue John episode to him. To me, this was a most remarkable coincidence unless, of course, a contrived one with the object of perpetrating a hoax. This seems a little unlikely to me, however, and would, I am sure, if it were the case, have been discovered by Waverney could he have continued investigations. One of those in whom Waverney confided details of his visitor is a contributor in this issue of Gemini, the other is equally well known. There have been several cases of exchange of personnel with UFOs and cars involved. John Keel, R. Barry Collins, RD6 Killer Clark AO have documented such stories, as I mentioned in my blog entry UFOs and Covert Activities. Based on the data we have, there appears to be several different type of visitors as aliens among us, possibly with different agendas. But the alien visitors who Joel Marchamont became involved with obviously were benevolent and were here to help this unhappy little planet. At the same time, they were pretty realistic about our future. They once remarked to Joel, "What a beautiful planet. Such a pity you're destroying it." Timothy Good, Alien Base, P. 256. 7. Miscellanea. Round Robin and Contactee History. In October 1983, AFU received a large and well-preserved collection of books and magazines donated by Mr. C. O. Holmquist, Rockenby, Sweden. Among the different sets of magazine issues dating back to the 1940s were an almost complete set of Round Robin, Volumes 2, 34. Round Robin was edited by Mead Lane, who founded Borderland Sciences Research Association, BSRA, in San Diego 1946. This publication is a unique document and a basic source of data on early UFO contactee history. I have for years been trying to find the missing early issues to make the AFU collection complete, but so far no luck. A few weeks ago I found a very informative article, Newton Mead Lane as Fortean, written by independent scholar and Fortean Joshua Bluebuzz on his blog from an oblique angle. Joshua also mentioned that he had found a complete set of Round Robin at the California History Room section of California State Library. I sent an email to the library requesting information about the possibility of receiving photocopies of Volume 1 of Round Robin. On March 10th, I was informed by Miss Kathleen Kerr that Volume 1 of Round Robin contains approximately 230 pages and that the library is unable to provide such extensive photocopying. She referred to various private researchers who could provide the service for a fee. As AFU is a not very rich non-profit foundation, I hope some ufologists or Fortean's in California could give us some help instead. There is much interesting historical data on early UFO contactees to be found in the early issues of Round Robin. The San Diego area was something of a cradle for the UFO contact movement. And it all started on October 9, 1946, when hundreds of witnesses observed a UFO over San Diego. In the classic Flying Saucer Have Landed, George Adamski presents his version of what happened. I had never given too much thought to the idea of interplanetary travel in man-made ships. This subject had never entered my mind until late in 1946. I, too, believed the distances between planets to be too great for spanning by mechanical constructions. But during the meteoric shower on the 9th of October 1946, I actually saw with my naked eyes a gigantic spacecraft hovering high above the mountain ridge to the south of Mount Palomar, towards San Diego. Yet I did not realize at the time what I was seeing. As many of us will remember, people everywhere were asked to watch the heavens that night and count the numbers of meteors falling per minute. This we were doing at Palomar Gardens. When, suddenly, after the most intense of the shower was over and we were about to go indoors, we all noticed high in the sky a large black object, similar in shape to a gigantic dirigible, and apparently motionless. I noticed that no cabin compartment or external appendages were visible, but I figured that during the war some new types of aircraft had been developed and that this was one of them. My calculation was that it was up there to study the falling meteors at that high altitude, so I gave no further thought to it, except to wonder why it was so totally dark. While we were still watching, it pointed its nose upward and quickly shot up into space, leaving a fiery trail behind it which remained visible for a good 5 minutes. Still thinking nothing of it, we all returned into the house and turned on the radio to a San Diego station where a newscast was being given. All of us were surprised and incredulous as we listened to the announcer say that a large cigar-shaped spaceship had hovered over San Diego during the shower and that hundreds of people had seen and reported it. The description tallied with what we had seen. Another witness to the San Diego UFO was the remarkable trance medium Mark Probert, who became an important member of the BSRA group. Mead Lane called Probert and suggested he try to get some information from his contacts regarding the strange object. Probert received the message that the object was interdimensional, etheric, and the people on board had for years been trying to contact and wished to meet a committee of scientists at an isolated spot. Mark Probert on the front page of Ray Palmer's Mystic Magazine 1955. This was one of the first claims that UFOs represented aliens from another world. Obviously, there was also some contact between George Adamski and the BSRA group, as reported in Round Robin, Volume 8, Number 5, January, February 1953, 11. On January 3, 1953, Mark Probert and Mead Lane visited the Adamski home at Palomar Gardens and a seance was held. About a dozen people were present, among them George Hunt Williamson. The discussion concerned the recent landing of a disc and a brief interview between its occupant and Mr. Adamski, also recent radio communication with the disc people or guardians. A study of the early BSRA history and the early issues of Round Robin could give many clues to the beginning of the UFO contact movement. Hopefully AFU will soon obtain a complete set of this unique publication. For several years I have been deeply concerned regarding the future fate of the Archive of Borderland Sciences Research Foundation, BSRF. On the internet I watched a video sequence showing the archive in a terrible mess, housed in a garage in Eureka, California. Mead Lane, together with Max Freedom Long, founded Borderland Sciences Research Associates, BSRA, already in 1945, and many of the early 14s and ufologists were involved with this group. From a historical and research viewpoint, the BSRF archive is of paramount importance. Custodian of the BSRF archive in Eureka was James Borges, but he had no time or possibility to arrange or scan the collection. Klis Svahn, UFO, Sweden has for many years made regular visits to the UK and other countries in order to risk UFO and 14 archives for preservation at AFU. Because of Klis and colleagues' tenacious efforts to retrieve archives from all over the world, Bob Rickard has named them the Viking Raiders. And Klis also succeeded this time, convincing James Borges that the best option for preserving the BSRF archive was at AFU in Sweden. During a trip to the US in June this year, Klaus and his sons Nicholas and Marcus met James in Eureka and together packed 72 boxes of material, among dust and spiders. On July 29, the archive finally arrived at Defu. Of the BSRF archive unpacked at Defu. Recently I spent 2 days for a first inventory and perusal of this invaluable collection.